Redacted Media presents, in association with Ghost Hat Media, the Filmological Society Essentials, a podcast conversation on the films that made cinema. And now, here are your commentators, Chris Schulz and T.C. DeWitt.
Welcome to another podisode of the Filmological Society, the Essentials Show. Where, again, this is where we delve into those films from yesteryear. And that we're not talking about modern films. We're going to talk about films probably 1970 or older at this point that have influenced and shaped the way that we see films today. So on our first episode, it was Rebel Without a Cause. And TC and I both agreed that that was for sure a film that fit that criteria.
Yeah.
This week, we are reviewing 1954's Seven Samurai, and we are joined... Well, first of all, I'm your host, Chris Schulz. Let you do that first. I'm terrible at doing that. With me for this series is T.C. DeWitt. Hello, T.C.
Konnichiwa. Is that offensive?
I don't think so.
Okay, cool. Hi.
Yeah.
And if it, saying hello Japanese? Well, no.
If it is, that's probably more clicks. So
Okay.
Yeah. I'm okay.
Right. Ride the controversy.
Yep. And joining us for this week is Chad Halverson, who you may know from the Countdown show that he does with us. Hello, Chad.
Yeah, speaking of that show, I every time we do one of these, I pull up my different tabs of things I want to look at.
Yeah.
And I pulled up the comedy list as you were saying the show. And I'm like, oh, God, I'm such a stupid idiot.
It's okay.
Why would Seven Samurai be on a comedy list?
It's okay. It's okay.
Hi, how's it going?
Good. All right. So, Seven Samurai. So this was a film I know I hadn't seen before. TC, I don't believe you had seen this before either. Is that correct?
No, I'm aware of it in terms of film study, like the importance of it, and we can discuss that surely. And there were moments from it that I had seen before, but as an entire film, no, I had not seen this. The only Kurosawa film I'd ever seen in its entirety is Ram, which is the Macbeth.
And then Chad, had you seen this film before?
Same boat as TC, but I had never seen a Kurosawa film. But I went to film school. I had conversations. The scene of the duel, like I saw that in a film class before. So, yeah.
So this is the film that's kind of looked back on as being the action film. If that makes sense.
For the
1950s? Well, just what, like, really, like, modern action films from, 1960 when, some of this film started to be remade. Basically, this is the big inspiration. I mean...
Can I jump in?
Yeah, absolutely, please.
Okay, so just, the shot in Return of the Jedi... where Emperor Palpatine's like, he's like Lightning Luke. It's like, and he's like, ha, 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 ha. And there's that shot. It's like a close up of Vader. And he looks left, he looks right, and it cuts back and forth to like who he's looking at. So one is the Emperor, with a grimace and just doing this, and then Luke's like, "No, Father, please." They did that shot a ton in this movie, but. I always knew that Star Wars or Lucas was a big fan of Kurosawa, but like finally seeing the source material for a lot of the visuals. There's a script to this movie and there's a story obviously, but it's a visual movie more than anything. And the scene of Vader looking left and looking right, Kanbe does that, when the father beats the daughter.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And he's just looking like, and a lot of times that moment happens where somebody has to make a decision. They're just taking their time and figuring out what's going on. Like once I saw that shot and connected it, like everything clicked, like where all this inspiration for all these different movies comes from, just the, man, yeah, like the rule of thirds in this movie was
the beat through the door, the stick, like beating someone over the back of the head if they walk through the door was a good 1-2-3 punch.
Yeah,
that look back and forth, double inspiration points there where it's the, unfortunately, I'm not going to do well with any of these characters' names.
No.
But it's the same.
Let's start with that and saying we are going to butcher some of these names, and please forgive us
please
for that.
Please forgive us.
We're doing our best.
There's the very calculating samurai, the one who has the face-off against the guy where they just pose against each other.
Kyozo.
Yeah. His moment where, like, when we see him fight for the first time against that guy who's challenging him, first they do it with sticks, and he's like, if we had done this with steel, you'd be dead. Oh, no, that whole scene. That moment where they're posing, you can see, if you've never realized just how samurai-inspired the original trilogy of Star Wars is, here you go. And even that looking back and forth of our leader of the group, looking back and forth and seeing the ability between these two men without them ever even moving their swords. Like, that's that look that you see of, like, Vader looking back and forth. I think... I may be wrong here. Schulze, you could definitely tell me if I'm wrong or not.
You're wrong.
What? I'm Rom? Thank you. The guy who leads the samurai, the first samurai who signs up.
Yeah.
Was he the inspiration and even asked to be Obi-Wan Kenobi?
I don't think he was asked to be Obi-Wan Kenobi.
Okay.
I think it was always like Lucas wanted an established star to kind of be a name in there. So, and Alec Guinness provided that.
Okay.
But inspiration? Absolutely. Sure.
Definitely.
But as far as going back to your first point about this being like a definitive action movie, And I will say this for those who might watch it now, this is not action as we know it. This is there's nothing fancy about this. There's nothing romanticized about it. There's nothing clean about it. These battle sequences, fight sequences, for the most part, are sloppy and dirty. And that's probably way more realistic to what this sort of thing really looked like than the very fantastical, choreographed sheen that we get in even samurai and fighting films we get now. This is muddy and gross.
And yeah, we're not getting like blood and guts.
No.
We're getting a lot of like forced perspective, slashing of a sword, person falling down. And, you know, it's all assumed. And yeah, it's not, I mean, at least for me, you know, I always put in the frame of mind of when this film was made, 1954, like, you know, less than 10 years after World War II, like, you know, we're making movies, but we're not doing crazy effect shit yet. Just a lot of practical stuff.
A lot of this, like, performance, a lot of the technique. Not the technical filmmaking aspect, but just the performance aspect of this. I can see Kabuki theater. There's a lot of performing from these actors, especially the older ones, that comes from a very exaggerated perform for the back row. One of the characters, again, not going to know names, he's one of the older guys who keeps making this, like, frown with his mouth.
Yeah, the one peasant, the older peasant.
And that looks like a kabuki mask. That looks like someone who painted his face for the stage and grew up on the stage. So as much as you can look at, say, pre-Rebel Without a Cause, to stick with our show here, you can look at more classically trained actors who came from the stage and how older movies from the 40s into the 50s and into the early 60s before that method acting was a lot of stage performing that was being filmed. You could see a lot of kabuki Japanese theater, Japanese opera acting in a lot of the performances here. Not to the detriment. This movie was phenomenal. Like,
it was amazing.
I can't believe. Sorry, I'm just going to keep going because I'm just so excited here.
Good.
This is a 3.5-hour movie.
Yeah, let's talk about the approachability of this film from somebody in the modern era.
Yeah.
Okay, it's 3.5 hours. It's black and white.
Mm-hmm. It's foreign.
You have to read. It's foreign.
No dub.
So you
do not get
subtitles.
To cheat with the dubs.
And it's a slow burn.
But
the acts are so perfectly built.
Yeah.
You have let's talk a little bit about plot, okay? Because the plot is simple. There's bandits that are terrorizing these farmers and stealing all their goods. So the farmers decide to hire samurai to save them. They have nothing to give except for food. So really, they're hoping for the goodwill of samurai, who at this time are a little corrupt.
Mm-hmm.
They're fighting for money. They're not the honorable people that they once were. It's a plot that was in so many other films. Three Amigos had the same plot.
Bug's Life.
There's so many movies based off this premise.
The only difference here is in Bug's Life and Three Amigos, those idiots were not, they were frauds. They were con men. Yeah. They didn't know. But in this, these samurai that they find are damn fine samurai.
Yeah. And so it's a simple plot. This was like the first time that this plot was kind of put into action, mm-hmm. though. Kurosawa and the two people he wrote this with, they put themselves away. They got themselves away for 45 days. They were isolated with no outside contact whatsoever for 45 days to write this script.
Mm-hmm.
At the time that they wrote it, they had 6 samurai.
Yeah.
So the actor, Mifune, Toshiro Mifune, who's,
Kyocho.
Yeah, he's the, there's really no main character, but he could be one of the main characters.
Mm-hmm.
It was him, and we'll talk a lot about him, I think, or we'll get into him a little
bit. He's definitely the most interesting character.
Was he the dog, like, the one that they all laughed, like...
He was the farmer's orphan.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. The wild guy.
The one that was kind of, yeah, mm-hmm. he was
the one. They're coming! Yeah!
So, he was originally going to be the one peasant who kind of, like, drove. Like, the one that lost his wife. That had his wife kidnapped by the bandits.
Rikichi.
He was originally going to be him, but Kurosawa thought he could do more, so they added the 7 samurai. I think they realized that without that 7th one, like, all the other 6 samurai just aren't as interesting when you don't have that additional one
there'd be no internal conflict within the group mm-hmm. of samurai. There's already conflict between the villagers and the samurai, but not internally, which creates a more dynamic
They make fun of, they name him, and they're making fun of him. He's this loose cannon,
like the whole time.
Wild man, and he becomes such a hero by the end of this.
Yeah, and his name, apparently, is what I read in trivia and something, so it may be wrong or right, but it's one reason that they make fun of him as well is that the name is 2 female names put together.
So like a Mary Jane?
Yeah, like if we started calling you Mary Jane.
Oh,
Like that would be it. Like, and you'd be like, all right. And like, hey, look at, there's Mary, so they, yeah.
Well, and his papers said he was like a 14-year-old boy.
Because he clearly stole a baby.
Yeah, he clearly stole it.
Here's my family lineage. Nah. So he was just some like wandering orphan.
And it was cool. I mean, he did have to prove himself. Like, yeah, he was like following him like a stray dog. Mm-hmm. But, he's like fishing out of the river. I've always wanted to do that, just like throw my hand in the river and pull a fish out.
He's got some of the coolest moments. When he gets the second musket, where he just kills a guy, steals his helmet, sits down next to their sniper, essentially. He's like, boy, these peasants, right? Hey, let me see your gun for a second. Wow, this is a nice gun. Then he hands it back to him, and the gunman's like, what? And then he comes back like, Yeah, there you go. And he's admonished for it, rightly so, but it's still a real cool way for getting that second gun out of the equation.
Well, it was he was sort of bragging about it, and he left his post versus Kyoto, who was like ordered to go get a rifle.
Yeah.
And he killed 2 people and came back. So Kikuchiyo, he's always trying to prove himself.
Yeah.
The entire movie.
Well, he's probably not an actual samurai, obviously.
Yeah, totally.
Right?
I kept thinking, I'm like, this is not 7 Samurai. Yeah. He's obviously faking it, but he's good.
He's got a sword that is way too big for him.
Mm-hmm.
I love that sword so much,
I do too, but it obviously doesn't fit him, right? like it's way too large for him. And it's, when you see Kusio fight... Versus, anyone else. But But, like, the sword is just, like, an extension of the arm. Mm-hmm. The way Kikuchiyo fights is he's kind of, like, swinging it more like a bat.
Yeah, well, you know? I mean, he's fighting like an animal. Now, they do make katanas that big.
They do.
And it's technically a katana. It's called a Okatana.
I'm not saying that it's one. It's wrong. It's just that it looks like it's purposefully made to be too big for him. Like, it doesn't quite fit him. Like, it wasn't made for him.
Yeah.
You know, like to me, just looking at it, it just kind of, it always looks like it's kind of awkward on him. Like, he's not comfortable with it. But
I saw it as, like, an extension to his, like, anger. Because he always moved with it. Like, all the other samurai, they hold it on their belts, right? Like, like samurai do. And they pull it out when they fight. This guy doesn't keep it tied up unless he's, like, climbing a mountain or something. He's always carrying it in his hand, and he'll sit down and he'll smash it on the ground. He's always, like, has to announce himself that he's, you know, that he's there. So I get your point, but I think it was done. Everything in this movie was done deliberately. Everything.
Kurosawa, yeah. I did see one video essay that just looked at the first 8 minutes, including the 3 minutes of credits. And basically it said everything, like the entire story, and everything is established in those first, like the way that shots are made, the way that things are done, it establishes everything, and everyone knows the story in those first 8 minutes. And there's not a samurai introduced for like the first 45 or hour, you know, a half hour.
Yeah,
because the first hour is getting the band together.
It's interesting because this movie's been remade multiple times as The Magnificent Seven, the cowboy western, most recently with Denzel and Chris Pratt and a few others. And to introduce seven characters and giving them enough screen time that you care about each of them and not painting them as caricatures is not something that you can really do very well in a 2-hour movie. Right, like even
how many movies did it take Marvel to do that?
Right,
or Avengers, you know, because so, that's essentially what they did. Each of those was kind of introducing the characters and then bring them together for an Avengers film.
I've seen the Denzel one and it's fine. Like it's a fun movie, but it's like for all these forgettable characters. Now with the seven that we do get in the original, the seven samurai here, that's. There are it is difficult to like distinguish them because it's black and white, because it's foreign, because it's you know, messy. No one has like a distinct fighting style exactly, which is why, you know, our Wild Dog character sticks out so much and our leader sticks out so much and the young guy sticks out. You know, maybe I'm wrong. They all stick out just perfectly fine.
I didn't have a problem.
Now that I'm saying it out loud. But it's the runtime that works in this movie's favor, because though I sat down, I was like, Jesus, 3.5 hours. I want to say it didn't. Once it hit like the last hour, which is basically the fight, the battle that begins, that it clipped by so fast, I couldn't believe it. Like there was never a dull moment. It lulled appropriately. It wrapped up stories nicely. Like, it's a build, like you said, Chad. It's a slow burn to get to the point. But once it gets going, wow.
It's such a good burn.
It's not like it was like, you know, really lame and then at the end it got really good. Like it just slowly went through like all the emotions and the feelings, both from the samurai's point of view and the villager's point of view. And there's all these little subplots that are going on. And, you know, some people know that the young guy's hooking up with that one chick. Like
Shino. Like the only female character in the movie.
Yep. So I do want to talk, because I think that there are some important points here. And if we talk, focus a little bit on Act 1 and how Cam Bai is introduced. Like,
dude,
how many times in action films, like, when you're introduced to you know,
the
leader, the hero, and all that, it's the same sort of thing. And it takes a while for you actually to see them do some action. Go ahead, Chad.
No, that just the you know, we're introduced to him. You know, we're told that there's a kid in trouble. And then, you know, this big group of people are surrounding this guy shaving his head. And we find out that he's going to dress up like a monk and go up to the kidnapper and
have some rice for
him. I mean, basically just, yeah, he's like, here's some rice. Oh, and by the way, I'm going to kill you.
Here. Yeah. It says a thief who's kidnapped a child and is like, if anyone comes here, I'm going to kill this kid. And this monk, quote unquote, shows up and he's like, I brought rice. I thought you and the boy would be hungry. Throw it to me. Here's one. Here's two. And he just runs into the shack.
Yep.
And then it's silent. And then out walks the thief who just collapses.
So one thing in this film that I find so different from a lot of modern day films, and this was echoed in something that I had seen too. So I won't take full credit for this, but Kurosawa does a great job of showing the consequences of actions,
mm-hmm.
right? Because when you look at so many modern action films, the camera stays on the hero the entire time as they're shooting guns or kicking or whatever, and you don't see the full impact of what they do.
Oh my God, you're right.
Where this film, it's like the you don't see the sword go through the thief.
Mm-hmm.
But you see the consequences of that when he falls over dead, in slow motion, or, you know, when all the action in the fighting scene in the third act, you see the samurai swing their swords and then the camera is where the dead body is going to fall.
Mm-hmm.
So you see those consequences.
Wow.
How many other films do you see that? Like
very, very little,
it makes it heavier because
maybe John Wick movies.
No, you stick with Keanu looking cool. You know, to that point though, the way this ends, our hero says, "This we lost this battle, and the real victory goes to the peasants." And thinking about the culmination of the battles, you see a lot of the peasants winning the day. It's a lot of like beat down the bad guy after they've come riding in on a horse. And
I was gonna say that all connects to what Chris is just saying, like, you know, the fight scene essentially worked like this. They made three different like barricades where very little people could come in, and they made like one narrow gap where they would allow a couple people to come in, and then they chase them down, kill them, and then it was a really cool tactic. But when they let somebody in, and maybe a samurai took a swing at the guy, but the villagers were the ones that were like doing the killing. They, 10 of them with sharpened bamboo sticks would come up and stab them, and they'd stay on that shot. They wouldn't go to Kanbe, you know, running off screen.
Mm-hmm. And him nodding approvingly, like, good job. Way to defend your life. No,
we haven't talked about it yet, but my favorite thing in this movie, there's many favorite things in this movie, but Kanbe is like, hey, there's this problem. What do we do?
Wait, he rubs his head.
He rubs his head because there's no hair there. And he always goes.
So, and let me just point out. So, Kurosawa, his directing style, he would tell his actors to have one physical trait or one physical thing that they do as their characters, and to continue doing it during the film, so that audiences can remember that, oh, that's this person.
Yeah. Oh, that's great.
And connect with that. But also, it kind of drives the character of who they are. So, Kanbe always rubbing his head. I mean, first of all, it's his hair growing back. Right?
Like, it gets itchy.
It gets itchy, but also, like, it's him thinking. And also probably trying to remember who he is as a samurai and all that, because he cut off his bun.
Some amazing hair in this movie.
But, and you look at Kikuchiyo, like, he's got, like, this shoulder thing that he does throughout.
His strut.
Yeah, like, his right, he's got his strut and his scream and all that. Like, so I've only watched this once. I would like to watch it more just to kind of see at least the Seven Samurai, but also then some of the other main peasants, just to kind of see, like, what physical thing are they doing? I mean, obviously, that one that TC likes, it does the kabuchi face.
Yeah.
That, I think, has to be the one that he said, I'm going to do this every time.
That's Yohei. Yohei, by the way.
Yohei.
As much as we had discussed the advantage of actors watching Rebel Without a Cause to go to the theme of this podcast or this this segment of the Filmological Society talking about the essentials. Rebel Without a Cause was this showcase of an actor and an acting technique. This is a showcase and a study of directing.
Yeah.
And I'm sure, being the 1950s, that there are some directing techniques that would never fly now, being unions and safety measures and what have you. But just taking into account the masterclass happening here with Kurosawa, this, what you just said about, like, every actor have a thing that you can utilize to develop your character physically, that was a good call, because I can think of those physical things, even though I can't say everybody's names, I can think of those physical things, and it just triggers their story in the movie.
Yep.
So they went, like, way over budget on this movie.
Yeah.
Is this like an Apocalypse Now situation? Way over budget.
They were shut down twice.
Well, so the studio was putting all the money towards this other film that I'm guessing you guys haven't heard of before, Godzilla?
That's the Matthew Braddock one? They started it back then? Wow.
Yeah. Yeah, da-na-na, that was over budget as well. But, yeah. So
it's Toho. Oh, my God. I didn't even put that together until right now. This is a Toho picture. Yep. It's literally the first thing and last thing you see in this movie until Hulk Creator gets it. Oh, my God. Duh.
So let's talk a little bit about Kurosawa, because I agree that this is really an hour-long talk that should be focused completely on him.
Yeah.
If you want to know kind of the inspiration, so there is a great video essay by Every Frame of Painting. It's on YouTube on the study of movement in Kurosawa films. There's always something moving, whether it be whether it be groups, whether it be whatever.
The space, the camera, the...
Yeah.
There's so many different ways he manipulates what happens on screen.
It makes every shot interesting and engaging. There's always something going on, and it's nothing that's forced.
Mm-hmm.
Right? There is reason for all movement, and I think that is... it's hard to just fully understand what that means. Like as just watching the film.
Yeah, it's the deliberate choice to have not just the wind blowing in the funeral scene, but to have the dust blowing in the wind.
Yeah.
It's this very compelling static shot, but it feels so kinetic with the energy of the people. The way the flag flaps on the rooftop, like when the shot reverses, and it's the one guy puts it up on the rooftop.
Yep.
Cuccio. Yeah.
How that movement just stirs emotion. Mm-hmm. Like in that scene, so there's one of the samurai had been killed, and so they're burying him.
It was the funny one. They killed the funny one first. I was so upset about that.
Well, so there, you know, the villagers are all kind of standing in this like U position where the seven samurai are up top on top of the hill. And there's not much movement from the people, but the wind is kind of pushing. So you feel the emptiness that they all feel. Like, this is the first major death that they suffered.
Yeah.
You know, as with this current arrangement. And, it's just amazing, the movement. Another thing that with movement that Kurosawa does, you know, and from what I saw, he may have established this, but whenever characters are moving left to right across the screen, the audience feels positive about them. Like, this is the good guy movement, that type of thing. Whenever they move right to left, the audience feels these are bad guys. So in this film, whenever it's the villagers, the samurai moving, they're always moving left to right when they're moving across the screen. The bandits are always moving right to left.
Wow. See, wow, that's, again, incredible direction. Incredible choices being made on a very interesting level that you don't even consider this sort of stuff as a general movie watcher. Wow.
So Kurosawa was an artist first. So his storyboards, he actually painted them.
Damn.
He painted his storyboards, and you can find his art online, and it is amazing because it is like the visuals that he is using for the film as he's storyboarding. So he storyboarded the Seven Samurai in paintings.
I mean, part of the reason I think it's so good, especially for the time period, is the fact that they spent so much time on it. They went over budget. He refused to shoot on the soundstage at Toho. And he's like, no, I'm going to fucking build a village because it's going to look more authentic and it's going to feel authentic. And the audience is going to respond to that better. Like, you wouldn't have had those shots of like, and there's so many you could pick from this movie, but think of like how many times where you had a person in the foreground and they were like looking behind something like a tree and the camera would start left.
Yeah.
And then as the person would move past the tree, they look right. And then the camera would move right. Mm-hmm. And then it would move in and it would look through like a slat in the wall.
Yes.
Like, oh man, you wouldn't have, on a set, you wouldn't have been able to do that. Well, you wouldn't have had the depth.
My two favorite shots in the movie were it's the final image, but we see it a couple times before, is the swords in the dirt in the mounds, mm-hmm. in the memorial, the honoring of the dead. It's weird to like, I'm not trying to spoil, but we were talking pretty openly, but that
this is a film that came out in 1954. Even with all this, like, everyone should see this film.
Yeah.
Like, anyone who's into film should absolutely 100% see this film.
That shot of the four swords and them standing down looking, like, that's a beautiful shot. The shot that made me go, damn, was old man wants to die in his barn, and they cut to him and he's just kneeling. They're shooting from behind. You can see through the slats, the like the sunlight pouring through the smoke. It's a gorgeous shot. It's on screen twice, but it's very brief. But just that shot alone, it made me verbally, like audibly go, whoa, that's a good shot.
Can I credit the entire film as one shot and say I love that?
Yeah.
He was one of the first to really heavily utilize the telephoto lens.
Mm-hmm. Mm. Oh yeah.
So he was able to get some depth shots. Like, you have one thing with him is the staging of shots and how he uses every single inch of the frame.
Dude,
put something in there and using the telephoto lens to condense all this stuff and condense the all the layers going on. It's just amazing.
I know mise-en-scene is French, but what is it in Japanese? Because I feel like Kurosawa perfected it. Like, I've never in my life seen such a like perfect example of like what it means to not only visually figure out what your frame's going to look like and how your actors are going to move through it and how the set pieces are going to be, but like all of that together and so consistently done well, it's rare. It's so rare.
Right. Well, and Chad, as an editor, so some of those shots, like he has so many shots that it's a continuous shot and it's like a close-up to a wide to an over-the-shoulder, all in one shot, so there's no like there's no unnecessary cuts where instead of using three different shots and to do it three times, the actor has to do it once to get all three in that same, but you're using one lens, you're not changing out lenses.
I have to wonder with this every frame of painting approach that you get from someone like Kurosawa and going a couple decades ahead, you get getting a Kubrick, where the term comes from, the artistry's there, the results are there. I wonder if A, Kurosawa wasn't fun to work with, or if that very particular way of crafting film was hard to deal with, because the results speak for themselves, but having, when someone has a very specific, particular way of doing something, I can understand what might happen if you cross them on it. And I can't believe the studio tried to shut him down twice, and they just, I wonder if it was a matter of like, you've gone over budget, we're shutting it down. Okay, let's watch what we have. Okay, give him more money. This is definitely worth it. This is worth the headache. And because of that, how many people come up now and act like dickheads when they're directing a film because they think they have license to do so because of the greats? You know what I mean? Like working with someone who thinks, well, Kurosawa did it this way, so I can do it this way too. It reminds me of when Uwe Boll said he could have a four-hour movie in the name of the King of Dungeon Siege Tale because King Kong was a four-hour movie. So, three-hour. Because he thought, hey, Peter Jackson does a three-hour movie, I can do a three-hour movie too. Sorry, that was a lot. But I'm just wondering if Kurosawa was... I can understand the genius of the man, but I have to wonder, is this someone who was easy to work with?
I don't, he has a large group of actors that he, you know, that he had in a lot of his films.
That's, there you go. That says a lot. When actors continually work with directors, that tells you a lot about the director. I feel that, because if I won't pick a specific director, but when you hear about a director who has a bad rep, who has quote unquote done something bad, they need to be outed or they need to be taken down or canceled, right? And this isn't something that's a modern issue. I can go back over a decade and pick some directors as well. But they have more than a few actors who continue to work with them, then that difficulty of working with them often says a lot about the person who couldn't handle it and less about the person who did it. You know what I mean? I'm not trying to excuse bad behavior, but it tells me a lot that Akira Kurosawa had people who continued to work with him.
Yeah. And Toshiro Mifune, who played Kukichio, he basically, his career, and he is considered one of the best, like, Japanese actors of all time, mm-hmm. Was started because Kurosawa said, we need him.
Wow.
Like, I'm going, and he was like an assistant director at the time.
Oh, wow.
And he put his career on the line to get Mifune into a film.
Is this like a Johnny Depp, Tim Burton situation where it's like, I will do anything ever that you want me to do?
Maybe. Yeah, I mean, just... This is a study of film and using in film as an art form.
Mm-hmm.
More than most other films that I can... I can say I've seen. I mean... Again, the influence that this has, and it's not just like these big influences. It's even like the wipes, wipes used, are directly connected to Star Wars wipes.
Oh my God! Yeah,
and how they're used.
Yeah, to end axe by like and swipe.
Yep, and to kind of leave it you hanging, like, well, what happened?
Yeah, for sure. This there is some older techniques here that we take for granted now, and a lot of stuff that seems dated if you just take it at face value and try to take Seven Samurai and line it up next to something more recent, right? Like if you're gonna line it up, I always use the Marvel movies as an example because those are the blockbusters that we get now, but any like modern film and try to put Seven Samurai next to it, yeah, you're gonna be bored by Seven Samurai. You're gonna see things that, oh, that's dumb, like. But that's movies that are modern movies have a lot to thank Seven Samurai and movies of these essentials for, and it's developing a respect for the classics that can help develop a better film language that can then be used to create new and better films. So you better believe, like, for example, Batman Begins, Chris Nolan's Batman Begins, in order to inspire his cast and crew, Chris Nolan sat down and watched a theatrical with the whole cast and crew. They watched Blade Runner and he said, this is what we're going to do to Batman. Now, what does that mean? I don't know. How do you look at Batman Begins and Blade Runner and see the similarities? That could be up for debate, but to sit down with a group of people and say, let's watch Seven Samurai, art department, casting, costume, cinematographers, lighting team, visual effects team, that who's going to do the rain machine, actors, like, pay attention to your area. We're going to try to do this too. And that's what I think you need to look at the old school conventions here and appreciate them as opposed to deride them for being boring or old or weird. That seems like an odd choice in performance.
So let me ask you a couple of questions, TC. As a writer and director, mm-hmm. you are filming the scene where Kikuchiyo is trying to endear himself to the group, but they're still separated. Mm-hmm. Most of the group is up top, on top of a waterfall. They are cooking their dinner or eating their rice, mm-hmm. right? They have food. They're prepared. Kikuchiyo's down at the bottom of the waterfall trying to find a fish. Mm-hmm. He jumps in the water, completely goes underwater, and comes up with a fish. How would you set that shot up? How would you accomplish that?
Well, I mean, I would do a Kurosawa. No, it's as
a modern day director. As a modern day filmmaker, I'll tell you how he did it.
Yeah, as a modern filmmaker, I feel like you'd cover that from the group up top and Wild Dog below here.
Yeah, I mean, and more physically, more like how to get that fish.
Oh, well, I mean, what I would do is I would hide a fish in the water so that my actor could go underwater and come up with it in one shot. So it looked like he literally went down and caught it. That would be what I would want to do, to make it look like my actor literally, the character, went in the yep. water and got the damn thing.
So in this shot, how it was shot was that the actor... Mifune was only wearing a loincloth for this. There's a lot of male butts in this too, by the way.
I'm very comfortable with it.
I'm comfortable with it too. It's just kind of,
oh yeah,
once in a while I was like, oh yep, that's riding a horse, that's comfortable.
I've heard a bareback anyway, before, but oh yeah.
Anyway, so
thank you, Chad.
There's only and this was a interview I read from the actor. And he said, there's only, when I'm only in a loincloth, there's only one place to put the fish.
Oh, no. Oh, no.
So, the fish was in his loincloth. So, he had to go underwater, reach into his loincloth, and come up with the fish. Wow. He was told by the fish handler that these are live fish. Mind you, these are live fish that were just bought, like, from a marketplace and brought here to location, mm-hmm. not by a city. That, you wanna hold on to the fish. You wanna be firm but gentle with the fish. If you're too firm, mm-hmm. the fish will react and its bony fin will come up and poke you. So he was too gentle the first time, mm-hmm. and the fish jumped out and got away.
Bye.
The second fish, he was a little bit firmer, he said, but he still wasn't firm enough. So the fish got away again. Mm-hmm. The third one, he did hold a little bit too firm.
Oh, no.
And so he got his hand cut. Ugh. And the fish got away.
Take four. So, here we go. Can we please stop losing fish?
They had to send somebody back to the city. Yeah. To get more live fish.
So we get in three.
For Mifune to put into his loincloth just to get that shot.
No wonder this movie took 148 days to film.
Amazing.
I'm more than impressed. Again, we know this is on the top lists and
yeah.
of so many, these are on many lists. This movie's on many lists. There's so many directors, filmmakers, mm-hmm. people that work in the industry that, covet this film. But it's one thing to hear it.
Yeah.
It's a completely other thing to experience it.
The fact that it's 3.5 hours long and doesn't feel it is a credit to so many people involved. Kurosawa himself for crafting a film that doesn't.
Absolutely.
Because we've watched movies that are longer that sure feel like it's that you have to go.
Oh, yeah.
You know what?
Yes.
I'm gonna watch this in parts because it's just not engaging me enough to sit through the whole thing. I took one pause at intermission when I watched this, and then I was like, pause. I'm going to
and
the intermission I let run through because it was.
I was going to say I sat through the intermission.
I let it run through and I just like went to the kitchen and got some water and then, you know.
It felt like being at a stage show.
But
it's like, all right, yeah, the band's going to play. I'm going to go take a piss.
It also gave you a chance to kind of reflect, like to
you
could take a breath finally, like and what was going on. Mm-hmm. It was weird to see that it still was on the DVD too that I watched.
I would not have the guts, and I write for a living. I would not have the guts to write a screenplay this long and think that I could pull it off, because I script consult all the time. I rewrite scripts all the time. I that is what I do. And when I get a script that is 200 pages, my first thought is, this needs to be cut in half. Like, I wouldn't have the guts to say, like, I'm going to write a 3.5. Chad, you're going to produce for me. I'm going to give you a 3.5-hour movie. Don't let me do that. And I wouldn't do it to you because
no.
You have to be the top of your game to pull something off like this.
Yeah.
This is not an amateur film made by amateur filmmakers. This is a craftsman at work here.
Yeah. I mean, this obviously wasn't his first film.
I've been trying to find the screenplay for this, and the best I've been able to find are transcripts where people have not just transcripts of the dialogue, which annoy the hell out of me because those aren't scripts. Stop calling them scripts. It's I'm trying to find exterior Japan, like,
yeah,
but I cannot find all my resources. I can't find it. I could
don't know.
I did find a copy on Amazon. It was for sale, but I'm not paying $50 for it.
Yeah, this was like his 11th or 12th film that he did, so he had a lot of experience, and I think he established himself as, you know, as a quality director.
Mm-hmm.
So he, you know, it was also obviously a very different time. This was, like someone said, it was 10 years, not even 10 years after World War II had ended. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I think a lot of Japan was looking back at this time because this is during a civil war. Where, you know, there wasn't a strong central ruling emperor or anything at the time. Mm-hmm. And there was a lot of loose soldiers around that didn't serve any master anymore.
Yeah, and so Theron speaks to a point of watching this as a modern film. Like, so as a modern audience watching it, the subtext of screenplays that you can find in movies now, like you can look at Captain America, the Winter Soldier, and look at the doubt that people can have in their government, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's a newer convention, and that came about with the in the 50s, in like as we moved into method acting, where the actors were layering their performances in subtext. To go back and look at something like this, it's a lot of just text. There was a civil war, and the people of Japan were fighting for it. And there's certainly some analysis that can be said about the peasants versus the bandits, that it's the innocent people who don't live in the city who are being attacked by an outside foe. Japan was working on this. Toho was doing Godzilla, which was the net result of two atomic bombs going off in their country and devastating them. And I think there's some subtext to be had in looking at a story that's 500 years ago about the innocent farmers who are being destroyed by the powers of the outside without it being, you know, bashing you over your head. I think there is some subtlety and some subtext to be drawn from that. Maybe I'm looking too far into it, but I don't think so. I think it's deliberate that this is a story about the underdogs overcoming these monstrous villains who are just attacking for seemingly no reason.
And I think what is there too is there's that conflict that happens about halfway through the film where they walk in with all the stolen samurai gear.
Yeah. Where'd you get all this?
The samurai, six of them anyway, are very upset that the farmers have gone out and killed some of their own.
Mm-hmm.
And it's Kikuchiyo who you know, kind of level sets the samurai, saying, "What do you expect? You've been killing farmers for all these years, burning their fields, doing all that.
What do you expect them to do? Now you're asking them to defend themselves, but now you're on this side of things." Yeah.
And the bandits, they could be samurai.
They are wearing samurai armor.
They're wearing the gear. Yeah, they're wearing all that. So it could
also be stolen too. Yeah,
it could be. But you know, because we don't really know much about the bandits, you don't learn much about them. But you know, it's just that, you know, they all could be the same, raised the same way or whatever, and just some of them are, you know, pillaging, some of them are noble,
mm-hmm.
and it's just an interesting dichotomy of how they're kind of presented.
It is a marvel to me that Kikuchiyo was an addition, that they had their six, yeah. and they were like, "We're missing an X factor here," because he has the longest journey in this,
yes.
to prove himself, yeah. to the others, to getting the samurai armor and throwing it down to the group, and then being berated for it, but then berating them. And then to learn that he doesn't know his name because his family was killed by bandits and he was abandoned as a baby. We see him rescue a baby, holding a baby later, right? That's him, isn't it?
Yeah.
And he's crying. Yeah. He's like, "This baby is me. This is me."
Yeah.
Like, it's amazing how, what this movie would even be like without him there. So that's amazing storytelling. That's from just a script perspective, that excites me.
Yeah, and that's the thing. Like, I think with Kurosawa, there's so much. Like, we've talked a lot about what the camera did. And by the way, this was Kurosawa's first film that he did with multiple cameras.
Oh, God, yeah. That's amazing. That doesn't shock me, because there's some right. stuff happening in this movie that I'm like, "God, how many takes did this take?"
So, yeah, so that's the thing. It may not be multiple takes. Mm-hmm. It's just multiple cameras. And that causes the actors not to know what camera is going to be used. So they have to act to all the cameras.
Wow.
And they're going to do more with their body then, because they don't know. There's three cameras set up.
That's funny. You're giving
Chad
the... They
don't know which one's going to be used.
You're giving Chad the editor's dream before of, like, long, continuous takes, moving into close and wide. That'll make your life easier. Also, we shot it from three angles. So now... Yep.
Enjoy. I mean, at least most of it was outdoors.
Sure.
To get the natural light.
Mm-hmm.
So I do want to talk one last thing, the final battle scene. So the bandits are down to like 13 of them, and there's a neat way to keep track of all the bandits, and now they're dying, mm-hmm. as the leader's kind of crossing them out. They know how many there are.
Mm-hmm.
And so... the final battle scene, it's a rainy day. So that is like an ominous thing, right? Now in film, like whenever it's a rainy battle, you had it in Lord of the Rings.
Two Towers.
Star Wars used it. Like all these, you just have the rain pouring. It's muddy. It's dirty. You got... Ugh. And how the hell did horses not get killed on this thing?
That shocks me.
How did stunt actors not get killed by horses falling on them?
You get some close-ups of actors getting run over by horses and all that. Oh. Like people, like you see the extras. Like, but that last battle. So this was filmed
in the final battle where the camera just goes a lateral. It's that lateral move, just going left to right, where Kikuchiyo goes out from outside to inside where all the women are, to the, and then shoves the guy through
yes.
the, and you're shooting it from outside and through the cabin wall and then out the back.
Yes.
Door. Cool. Continue. That shot came back in my head again. I'm like,
cool. There's so many good shots, but, this was in, filmed in like January, February in Japan, which is winter.
Yeah.
So again,
mud
Mifune,
and rain. Are you kidding me?
The actor, Toshiro Mifune, in the interview, he also said that the ground, although it looks like mud, was rock hard. because it was frozen. So there, you know, he's jumping all over the place, landing on his back, jumping up and down, running.
His bare butt.
His bare butt. Like, there's a lot of bare butts there. But, yeah, it... I can't imagine. I mean, and then having all those group movements, which is a Kurosawa thing, as a director, TC, how would you even begin?
The first thing I would do, like in a situation like that, where I have to direct in that cold, which I have had before. Shulze, you and I co-directed something in the cold.
Yeah.
The occasions where I've had to direct in the cold, or direct in the water, or direct under extreme conditions, whatever actor that I have that's in the worst case scenario, I will match that. So like, if Kukichyo had to be bare bottom fighting in this mud, I would take my pants off too. Like, I just out of solidarity to be like, look, if you're uncomfortable, I'm going to be uncomfortable too, because I am grateful you're willing to do this, and this is how grateful I am. So that's what I would do in an attempt to keep the morale up. It would be, hey, if you're going to be rolling around the mud, I'm rolling around the mud with you. I mean, Chad, you produced something where we had to throw an actor off a roof, and I was the first one who took the jump. We built that whole stunt, and before anyone did anything, I did it first. And I know that's an insurance person's nightmare, but I'm like, if I'm going to ask an actor to jump two stories off a building, I'm going to do it first for the fun of it.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's what Kurosawa did, and I don't mean to make this about me, but
I don't know if he did. That's the thing. I think this whole episode could almost be a Kurosawa. I know we've only seen the one film that we're talking about.
I was gonna say I will be watching more of his stuff.
Ron, R-A-N, which is the Macbeth one, I highly recommend it because it's full Technicolor, and the red, blues, yellows of it. Just imagine the craftsmanship of Seven Samurai in full Technicolor. Like, it's a gorgeous film. I watched it in a Shakespeare class. That's why how I ended up on my radar. That and Rashomon is the other one that's his. Yojimbo, my God.
His last film was 1993.
Unbelievable.
That was the last film that he directed. So he does a lot of Shakespeare. He loves Shakespeare, but putting the Shakespearean elements into a Japanese.
This is a film. He is a director worth studying for technique, for moving groups and individuals through scenes. You look at someone like Spielberg, who's a master of blocking with the camera, blocking the actors with camera movements. And that technique is surely inspired by how Kurosawa did it, because moving seven individuals through a shot with camera movement and keeping the frame interesting and coherent is not easy. That is not something that should be taken for granted. And respecting seeing stuff now, like after watching something like this, I'm certainly, every time I watch a classic film, I start paying attention more to modern films to see who's utilizing techniques that were at least established or perfected decades earlier.
I think, and Chad, you know, from our other podcast, like, one of the things we talk about with a lot of those comedies is you got people, actors coming from the stage or directors that are used to theater. And even in this era, there still is a lot of the feeling where the camera is more steady and stable and all that. This is one of the earliest films that I know of where it doesn't feel like it's on stage at all. The camera is a character. The camera is an important element to the whole storytelling.
It's a technique that people take for granted, is establishing geography of an action scene, let alone an entire set piece finale, to understand where the map, we are literally seeing a map where everything is, and watching how everything unfolds. The geography is very carefully established through super wide looking down from the mountain and getting in. So you never really, even though as I initially said, this is sloppy and it's not as romanticized and slick as you see modern action now, the geography is established and it's and you're not going to get lost in the viewing of it, because you understand through blocking, through dialogue, through the visuals, where everything's coming from and where everything needs to go. It's cool.
So the list that Chad and I do, it's the BBC's top 100 comedies. The BBC also put out a list of top 100 foreign films of all time, which would be, you know, it basically doesn't include British or American films, Hollywood films. And it's rated by I think 100 different film critics. Like, that's who votes in these things. And this film was number one on that list.
I believe it.
Well done.
There were 7 Japanese critics that voted in that poll. Not one of them had this film as number one.
Really? Why did they like? Oh, wait. I'm trying to think if there's a more classic Japanese film.
Well, that's the thing. Like, Kurosawa's, it seems that his popularity is much more profound outside of Japan.
That's funny.
Like, there's more, like, classical Japanese directors that they clamor to.
The French love Jerry Lewis. The Germans love David Hasselhoff. Countries have their tastes.
But I just found that interesting that the rest of the world loves Seven Samurai. But when you get to Japan, they're like, eh, it's good.
I guess.
But it's not like Godzilla. I don't know what film was number one over there. But still, it's like, oh, that's surprising. Like, the 7 critics didn't put this film number one or even have as many Kurosawa films as the other critics did.
Critics. Amazing.
And again, they're not focused just on Japan. They're focused on all the other countries. Mm-hmm, so. Mm-hmm. All right, so let's wrap this up. I think it was a good talk. I know we could talk all night about this film.
Yeah, we could just pick a subject matter within this film and talk about it for an hour.
I do feel that this film was another success as far as what I'd like to get out of this series is just to get us talking about these classic films that everyone talks about already. Mm-hmm. A, get caught up, but B, learn something about filmmaking. And TC, I think you said it right before, Rebel Without a Cause is a study of actors. Mm-hmm. This was a study of Kurosawa, camera movement, cinematography.
Yeah, specifically as a director and moving moving the pieces of this puzzle around to click all into place. He's understandably a master and brilliant in this, and we're not saying anything no one else has said before us. Mm-hmm. But it's true. Like, this is, Shulz, you said, if you are someone studying film, if you fancy yourself a craftsman, this is worth watching to take note of.
Yeah. So let's have some closing thoughts. Chad. Any closing thoughts on this?
You got real quiet, Chad. Loving it. Did we say everything you were thinking?
Well, you guys were talking a lot, so I just shut my mouth.
Oh, well, now's your chance to talk a lot.
Now's your chance, Go, we're not going to interrupt you.
Go.
Go ahead, Chad. We're waiting.
The quote that Kembe had about war, and I'm trying to remember it real quick. Essentially, it was, here it is. So, this is the nature of war. By protecting others, you save yourselves. If you only think of yourself, you'll only destroy yourself. And it's a very basic line, but, like, I don't know.
Profound.
Geopolitical situations going on in our world right now, and the world always kind of sucks. I always tend to think there's good in everybody. Mm-hmm. And the way I try to be good is by helping other people. And that quote hit me. Not hard, but, like, it stopped me. I'm like, because it was right before the intermission, mm-hmm. too, when he says it. So, like, that's what I was thinking about during that intermission. Like, damn, I wish I could just, like, tattoo that to my forehead and make every person I meet read it. I don't know.
That's him as a leader. We talked a lot about Kuchiro. What's his name?
Kuchiyo, yeah.
The leader character is a phenomenal general. He is such an incredible leader. Watching him, I'm like, man, if I ever had to lead a group of people in the battle, I hope I could do it as well as him.
I like even early on, he said that he has never won a battle.
And he, oh God,
like he established like early on, and then to get that end line where he says we lost.
We lost this battle too, which
they won.
Which to go from his performance and him as a character says a lot about, you know what, he probably has won superficially a lot of battles, but
never for never himself. Chose,
yeah, for never for himself. Exactly. That's that's awesome. but sorry, Chad, you were saying.
Yeah.
No. That's what I wanted to say. Like that's my end note to this is that, you know, by protecting others, you save yourselves. If you only think of yourself, you'll only destroy yourself.
All right. TC, any final thoughts from you about this film?
Well, I've babbled pretty much the entire time. So as I can say one final time here, this is well worth a watch. This doesn't feel like a 3.5-hour movie. This does feel like an education. This is well worth the watch for the purposes of learning technique and appreciating technique. More so than, I know this will be weird to say, but like more so than something like Citizen Kane, which is a very academic viewing. This is an academic viewing as well, but there's so much to enjoy in so many elements of this that it's more entertaining and less academic. It's still a very academic film to watch, but this is a very entertaining film to watch, and I think that's important. For studying purposes, for crafting your own films in the future, and what I hope to craft as well. I know I do a lot of like funny stuff, but I'd like to think there's a developing of technique over time, and I'm gonna use this. I'm gonna keep this well in mind. Thank you for giving us a chance to even just like, you know, nerd out about it for an hour, Schulze.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I, you know, when I was kind of putting my notes and what I wanted to focus on our talk, I could have gravitated towards so many issues. I tried to focus more on Kurosawa and the camera techniques that he used and the shots and how he did things. But we could have talked more about story. And just how well put together this story was, and how all the characters, even the minor characters, you learned, and they had such depth in all the characters. We could have talked about the acting, which was so good from not only the Seven Samurai, but all the actors that were in there. So much that we could have talked about, but... I think to your point, like there's so much that could be looked at and studied from this film, and it to me it requires multiple viewings just to kind of pick all those other things out that are going on and just focusing on the movements of one character, just to see because there's only like two females in the entire film, only how he's moving or interacting with people, especially Kikuchiyo, but all the other samurai as well. It's fascinating. And again, this is the point of this Essential series is to look at these films and just be in awe and nerd out about them, because that's what they deserve, our nerding, I guess. So thank you both for joining. You know, we have quite a list already of the films that are going to be on here. I'm really hoping never to be disappointed by this series.
Yeah, I don't want to ever come across an Essential and go like, why? I mean, we are picking them, so it'll be on us. But when I think of your other series with the BBC 100, yeah. I've watched a few of these with you guys and gone, who made this list? I want names.
we're picking these, but also we're picking films based on what people have talked about in the past. Sure. And
we're not saying they're essential. The film world at large has said these are essential. Well, I hope Chad, I hope you'll come back for more conversations about
that. Yeah.
Fuck yeah. Films are like this. Hell yeah.
I mean, yeah, 3.5 hours. That was daunting. This was going to be our first film. But after we saw that it was 3.5 hours long, we went with Rebel Without a Cause to start out with, just make it more, you know, manageable for the first one. But I am glad that we stuck with it.
No, Seven Samurai felt like 0.45 of a Snyder cut to me in comparison. So it was very easy to watch.
Hey, Chad said it, not me. I didn't even, I never named names.
All right. Well, thank you both for joining again. Chad, you're welcome to join us for any of these other series. We can talk about some of the other films. Although I think TC, mm-hmm. what do you think about going back further in time and talking about Metropolis next?
I like that. Another Star Wars inspiration.
Yeah.
C-3PO.
Is Metropolis only like an hour long?
It's a silent era film. Yeah, I'm not sure if it's an hour or maybe
what they've been able to cobble back together since losing it. I think it's about an hour, but we'll see when we get there, won't we?
Yeah. So I think Metropolis may be the next one on our list. All so right. Thank you, everybody. I hope you enjoy your time outside without a mask.
The Filmological Society is a production of Redacted Media in association with Ghost Hat Media. For more information, find us on Facebook, YouTube, and Twitter, or visit us at www.ghosthat.net.